For he will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. On their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone. Please be seated. I'm not very confident about preaching a sermon on angels. The last time I mentioned angels in a sermon, I asserted that nowhere in the entire scriptures does it ever actually say that angels sing. Unfortunately, that was for a Christmas Eve sermon, so that didn't really go over very well. You're going to look it up, aren't you? It's true. But also, some of the sermons that I remember the most were about angels. I remember when I was a 7-year-old in a parochial school, my pastor in daily chapel one day carried on a conversation with an invisible angel who evidently flew in through the roof and stood right next to him. I couldn't hear or see anything, but evidently he had no trouble, and I was very impressed. And then, actually, my first St. Michael's and All Angels Day service here at the seminary as a student in 1995 was preached by none other than the Dr. Lewis Brighton. And that was an epic sermon. And come to think of it, I think he was also carrying on a conversation with invisible angels. In any event, no conversations with angels today. My thinking about angels over the last several years has almost entirely focused in a single direction: guardian angels. Nothing theologically sophisticated, nothing particularly surprising. It's just that I have 5 small children. Since the very first one was born, we've had a rather nice painting over the crib, a reproduction of one of Sister Maria Hummel's illustrations. It's Hummel, it's a little better than Precious Moments, of an angel looking a little bit like a child, but holding an even smaller sleeping child. And every night, we all pray the Catechism's evening prayer. Into your hands I commend myself, my body and soul and all things. Let your holy angel be with me, that the evil foe may have no power over me. Sometimes they've already fallen asleep, so I say the prayer over them. Let your holy angel be with me, that the evil foe may have no power over me. What parent doesn't pray for such protection for their children? What parent doesn't long to provide such loving protection for their children, to wrap them in a secure embrace, to keep them safe? And so, with such desires and prayers, what could be more beautiful than this psalm, Psalm 91? The Lord is my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust. For he will deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the deadly pestilence. He'll cover you with his pinions, and under his wings you will find refuge. His faithfulness is a shield and a buckler. You will not fear the terror of the night, nor the arrow that flies by day, nor the pestilence that stalks in the darkness, nor the destruction that wastes at noonday. 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near to you. You will look with eyes and see the recompense of the wicked. Because you have made the Lord your dwelling place, no evil shall be allowed to befall you. No plague will come near your tent. He will command his angels concerning you and guard you in all of your ways. On their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone. What beautiful words! Like a loving parent to his child, so God covers and shelters Israel, shielding him from all harm. What lavish, what a marvelous promise! Perhaps it's too marvelous. The promises here are extravagant. But are they believable? Does God really help his people in this way? Does he really keep his people from all harm? Does nothing bad ever happen to those who trust in the Lord? No suffering? No sickness? No tragedy? Do we not, in fact, experience so many times the opposite? When the famous London preacher Leslie Weatherhead preached on this psalm, he read their incredible words and then he concluded, "Men and women, it is just not true." And as I look around and I hear the prayer lists of my own congregation and of our own community here, Weatherhead may be right. Just try asserting the truth of this psalm to a mother who has just lost her child, or to a husband whose wife has been diagnosed with cancer. Try offering these universal assurances to one who has just lost his job, or lost their home, or to the families of soldiers who have lost their lives. These bright and beautiful words lose their sparkle. They sound hollow and empty. Indeed, they seem to mock us in our misery. We need only to read the previous psalm to hear a very different and very real assessment of our situation. The days of our life are 70 years, perhaps 80 if we're strong. Even then, their span is only toil and trouble. They are soon gone, and we fly away. Well, this is not the first time that the promises of this psalm have been questioned in this way. Long before Leslie Whitehead pointed to the elephant in the room, we hear the words of this psalm in the Gospel of Matthew. "Then the devil took Jesus to the holy city and set him on the pinnacle of the temple, and he said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and on their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone.'" As we all know, this happened to Jesus while he was in the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights. Having stepped out of the baptismal waters of the Jordan, all the promises of Israel are now set upon his brow. All the scriptures, Moses, the prophets, the Psalms, urge themselves upon this anointed one, this Christ. And like Israel, he passed through the waters and has been declared God's son. And like Israel, he now wanders in the wilderness. And like Israel, these creeping doubts and questions about God's promise of provision and protection tempt him, coming to him from the tempter himself. Even Israel was given manna from heaven. "Where is your bread?" Doesn't Moses say that their wanderings and their clothes did not wear out, nor did their foot even swell? Surely, as God's son, he will not even let your foot strike against a stone. Are these promises true, really? Or do the words mock you? Will they mock you when your family rejects you, when your disciples and friends abandon you, when the priests strike you and the soldiers flog you? Will these marvelous promises mock you when you are stretched out in crucified agony? "If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." Or will you finally come to realize that your God has forsaken you? Here is the great test, and we should never take it lightly. Does God really love us? Love us as he promises, as a parent loves her child, as a father loves his son. It is the test that produces saint and atheist, faith or unbelief. And Jesus does not take it lightly. Instead, he takes up the Sermon of Moses from Deuteronomy, where Moses reminds Israel of all that God has done, especially how he has freed them from slavery, rescued them from their enemies, and preserved them throughout their sojourn in the desert. You see, all of Jesus' responses to the devil here come from the same section of this sermon, so that when he rebukes the tempter, "You shall not put the Lord thy God to the test," he is recalling specifically Israel's doubts over God's promises for provision and protection when they grumbled against him in the wilderness and, quote, "put God to the test." As Israel faced the hardships of their desert wanderings and continually forgot all of the great things that God had done and grumbled against that which by comparison were little things, think of the great salvific events of having been redeemed from bondage, having escaped the plagues and the deadly pestilence of the Passover night, preserved from the arrows of Pharaoh that fly by day, and the armies as they witnessed the horse and rider drown in the sea. Was it 1,000? Was it 10,000? Whatever the number, they did not come near, and instead Israel looked with their eyes and saw the recompense of the wicked. And even though their sojourn in the desert was fraught with difficulties, Moses assures them that they are receiving discipline as a man disciplines his son. His son. God is their father. And everything they experience from the beginning to the end is an experience of the love of a father for his son. But Israel passes over such wonderful declarations of God's love, and they murmur against God because of the monotony of manna. And so Moses says that Israel put God to the test. And we see this repeatedly. The Psalms tell the same story. Psalm 78, "They forgot his works and the wonders that he had shown them. He divided the sea. He let them pass through it. He led them by day with a cloud and at night with a fiery light. He split the rocks in the wilderness and gave them abundant drink, made the rocks flow like rivers. Yet they sinned against him. They tested God in their heart." And Psalm 106, the same story. "He rebuked the Red Sea and it became dry. He led them through the deep as through a desert. He saved them from the hand of the foe and redeemed them from the power of the enemy. But they soon forgot his works. They had a wanton craving in the wilderness and put God to the test in the desert." But in this sermon of Deuteronomy, Moses now warns, "Do not put God to the test as you tested him at Massa. Do not forget that God has such great promises of deliverance and protection. Do not abandon his even greater promises in the future of a land flowing with milk and honey." And so with all of this, Jesus says to the devil, "You shall not put the Lord your God to the test." No. Jesus will not allow the devil and his doubts to determine the destiny of Israel or deny the power of these promises. These promises are true. And they are true in a greater way than we would allow it. But it is Jesus who brings these promises to their greatest fulfillment. And he does it, surprisingly, when he shuns the protection of angels. At the night of his arrest, he rebukes Peter for drawing the sword on his behalf. "Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? But how then shall the scriptures, and yes, even these scriptures of Psalm 91, be fulfilled that it must be so?" And so Jesus, bearing the mantle of Israel, indeed bearing the burden of Israel's sonship, unrealized because of constant capitulation to the temptations of the evil one, Jesus enters into the waters and wasteland once more, unattended, unprotected, utterly alone. And having passed through the deep, dark river, having crossed over the desert of death, that great terror of the night and pestilence that stalks in the darkness, Jesus receives the full promises of God as his Son. Raised from the dead and ascended to the heavens, borne up in the hands of angels, the words of this psalm resound: "You will tread on the lion and the adder. The young lion and the serpent you will trample underfoot. Because he holds fast to me in love, I will deliver him. I will protect him because he knows my name. When he calls to me, I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will rescue him and honor him. And with long life, I will satisfy him and show him my salvation." What beautiful words. What marvelous words. What extravagant promises. And they are true. More true than we could have ever hoped. For God's protective love reaches beyond the cords of death. And they are promises that are for you. For you are sons. As St. Paul says, God has sent the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying, "Abba, Father," and all who are led by the Spirit of God are sons of God. The Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit, and we are children of God. And if children, then we're heirs. And what father doesn't long to provide such loving protection for his children, to wrap them in secure embrace and keep them safe, to shield them and to be their refuge? In God's Son, we have found such love and refuge. Even as we await for the full revealing of the sons of God, that freedom and glory of the children of God, that is our very inheritance. And so until that day, we pray, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. Oh, and let your holy angel be with us, that the evil foe have no power over us. Amen.